Anyway, the title of my message today is The Times. And if somebody asked you what the best time of the year is, what would you say? Would you think about things like summer or spring? Surely you would not pick winter. Would you pick events like birthdays or the weekends? Believe it or not, there are people who look forward all year to NASCAR or even, wait for it, soccer. I honestly have no idea if the soccer season ever ends or does it just go on forever like the games do. That's just for our European friends. So what is the best time for you? For me, hands down, beyond question, the best time of the year is the Feast of Tabernacles. And I love everything about the feast. I love planning for the feast. I love preparing for the feast. I love thinking about planning, about preparing for the feast. I just love everything about it. We pack up our stuff. We leave our homes. We go someplace to be together every day, to be fed positive, uplifting messages every day. I would be a different person if I didn't have the experience of the feast. Is that true for you? What would your year be like? What would you be like if you never kept the feast? It's just a truly unique experience. We get to see and talk with and eat with and build memories with each other every day. And these memories, to me, are priceless. One of the priceless memories I have since keeping the feast in the UK is instant coffee. And when Melissa and I went to the feast for the first year in the UK, we were amazed by two things. One is the complete lack of choice. So you go to the grocery store and you get ketchup, not 57 types of ketchup. And no brewed coffee. In 6 years, we have been unable to find brewed coffee. My theory about this is that the British are taking revenge on Americans for the Boston Tea Party. And that's all you get, brewed, or instant, sorry. So has anybody ever had Nescafe instant coffee? Get one hand up in the back. I didn't like it at first, but it has become one of my absolute favorite things in the world. And I actually made some last night and put my little crystals in the mug, and I heat up my water, and I pour it in, and that smell just brings back this flood of memories about the feast. And the reason is that one of the nice things Melissa does for me at the feast is every morning I wake up, and she comes in with my little hot cup of instant coffee. And it seems tiny, meaningless, whatever, but it's one of those traditions that makes the feast so precious and rich. I was talking to Melissa about this last night, and I said, if you and I took two cups and we both made instant coffee and a molecular analysis was done to show they're exactly the same, yours would still taste better. And then she said, why? And I said, because you made it. And then she smiled and said, that's because it was made with love. So pretty cheesy. One of the great opportunities that comes with God's calling is the opportunity to keep the feast, the opportunity to strengthen relationships, to be reminded about God's plan for us and for the world, the opportunity to be with the begotten family of God, and the opportunity to be strengthened through the spiritual food we get every day at the feast. Ephesians 3, if you want to turn there, Ephesians 3. We'll read verses, starting verse 14. For this reason, I bow my knees to the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, from whom the whole family in heaven and earth is named. And that's easy to skip past. From whom the whole family is named. Revelation 3, verse 12, I'll read for you. Revelation 3, verse 12, he who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God. I will write on him the name of my God. Being a family, being born into God's family, is part of what the feast pictures. Ephesians 3, verse 14, again, for this reason I bow my knees to the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Verse 16, that he would grant you, according to the riches of his glory, to be strengthened. To be strengthened with might through his Spirit in the inner man, that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may be able to comprehend with all the saints what is the width and length and depth and height. To know the love of Christ, which passes knowledge, that you may be filled with all the fullness of God. So the feast is about being filled and about being strengthened. So why talk about this now? Why do Melissa and I try to invent post-feast traditions for ourselves to stir up and treasure up the memories of the feast? And the answer is simple, because of what comes after the feast, going back into the world, not of the world, but most definitely in the world. Did you wonder, when the feast ended, what kind of a world would you come back to? Would Israel bomb Iran? Melissa and I were in Europe, and I'm wondering, if that happens, are we going to even be able to get out of the country? Did you worry about the economy? When the feast was over, what kind of a world would we come back to? So while I'm sitting on the plane at the tarmac in Manchester, the stewardess comes down the aisle, and she has this tray full of newspapers and magazines, and while she wasn't looking, I snuck one of the Financial Times from her. It was fine. She just, you know, I was still felt sneaky. It's the first newspaper I'd read since the feast was over. And I have to tell you, it was an instant, hard reminder of the times you and I live in. And let me give you some examples. And this is from, these are from the Financial Times dated October 10th, 2012. So what would you guess is the front page picture in the Financial Times that day? Would it have anything to do with the Bible? The picture was of this line of police officers, 10,000 people behind them, an angry mob in Greece protesting Angela Merkel's visit to Greece. And the caption says this: German chancellor was confronted by mass protests. Many Greeks blame Berlin for the austerity plans choking their country. So what times do we live in? We live in times where austerity is a common word and a common experience, where mass and violent protests are common. You and I live in the time when the nations of Europe are led by Germany, and they are partially strong and they are partially weak. What did that picture have to do with the Bible? Daniel 2, verse 42. This is speaking about Nebuchadnezzar's vision of the 10 kings and the 10 toes and the end of this time. Daniel 2, verse 42 says, and the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay. So the kingdom shall be strong, and partly fragile. So for me, the very first picture on the very first newspaper I see after the feast is prophecy being fulfilled. What caused that crisis? What caused Greece and the other nations of Europe to to become subject to Germany. The Financial Times said this: the shift in power from Brussels to Berlin has been accelerated by the euro crisis. Germany is strong. Other nations in Europe are weak. Article continues, the price of German financial assistance is increasingly going to be the acceptance of rules and laws designed in Berlin. Prophecy being fulfilled in our times. So what caused this global financial crisis? Why did it have to happen? The U.S. Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, in a report on January 2011, said this: the crisis was avoidable and was caused by widespread failures in financial regulation, dramatic breakdowns in corporate governance, including too many financial firms acting recklessly and taking on too much risk. It says there were, quote, systemic breaches in accountability and ethics at all levels. These are the times that you and I live in. Another article says the crisis was triggered by a lack of adequate capital holdings from banks and insurance companies to back the financial commitments they were making. To put it in simpler terms, the banks didn't have enough money in the bank to back the loans that they made. Why does this matter? And have we learned from that crisis? So guess what the very first line on the very first page of the very first article was in the Financial Times. It says, quote, crucial capital and liquidity rules for the biggest UK banks have been quietly relaxed in an effort to stimulate what? Savings? In an effort to stimulate lending. A move that puts Britain at the forefront of a global experiment to use bank regulation to moderate the economic cycle. So lending created the crisis. How is it that lending is going to get us out of the crisis? This all has a point, by the way, which I'll get to in a moment. Continuing, it says, London regulators have also stepped back from tough overall capital rules they imposed. Banks can treat lending as virtually risk-free for regulatory purposes. So notice these words: global experiment, quietly relaxed, which is fine if you are on a vacation in the Bahamas, right? It is utterly frightening if you're talking about the rules designed to prevent another financial meltdown. And think about what happened during the last meltdown. Trillions were lost in the stock market. Millions of jobs were destroyed. Millions of homes were foreclosed. And translate that into something personal. So foreclosure means somebody comes to you and says, give me your keys and get out of the house. Greed and poor decisions just put us through those times. What kind of times are the new experiment and the new relaxation likely to produce? The article continues, quote, analysts warn that the shift could provide the industry with the first real opening to water down UK standards since the start of the financial crisis. Warned and watering down standards. Does that make you think of any warning in the Bible? Deuteronomy 28, starting in verse 15. Deuteronomy 28:15 says, but it shall come to pass, if you do not obey the voice of the Lord your God, to carefully observe all his commandments and his statutes, which I command you today, that these curses will come upon you and overtake you. And if you were to keep reading, you would read about national and personal curses resulting from ignoring God's standards. In verse 44 and 47, we see that these include national financial curses. Deuteronomy 28, verse 44, the foreigner, shall lend to you, but you shall not lend to him. He shall be the head, and you shall be the tail. And why does this happen? Verse 47, because you did not serve the Lord your God with joy and gladness of heart for the abundance of everything. And which nation and company of nations have had more of an abundance of everything than any countries in the history of history? And of course, that's the United States and the United Kingdom, blessed with more prosperity, more abundance, more freedom than any countries ever. And what have our nations done with it? Instead of serving God and each other, we serve ourselves. Isaiah 5, verses 1 through 6. Isaiah 5, verse 1. My well-beloved has a vineyard on a very fruitful hill. He dug it up and cleared out its stones and planted it with the choicest vine. Verse 4. What more could have been done to my vineyard that I have not done to it? Why then, when I expected it to bring forth good grapes, did it bring forth wild grapes? And now, please let me tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will take away its hedge, and it shall be burned, and break down its walls, and it shall be trampled. I will lay it waste. It shall not be pruned or dug, but there shall come up briars and thorns, and I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain on it. Will we experience anything like this in our times? The next article in the Financial Times on October 10th was entitled this, quote, Wine Estates Harvest Withers on the Vine After Damp Summer. The article says, quote, England's biggest wine estate has to scrap harvesting this year because of the poor weather. It becomes the first big producer to scrap an entire harvest, although other vineyards expect production to be down by between one-third and two-thirds, making wine the latest casualty of Britain's cold, wet summer. Erratic weather patterns from floods to drought mean other parts of Europe are also looking to reduce wine harvests. Have there been other times that you can think of such massively reduced harvest? You don't have to turn there, but in Haggai 2, verse 16 and 17, it says this. When one came to a heap of 20 ephahs, there were but 10. When one came to the wine vat to draw out 50 baths from the press, there were but 20. These numbers are not far off from what we just read about the wine harvest, or the corn harvest, or the soybean harvest, or the wheat harvest. Haggai 2, verse 17, I struck you with blight and mildew and hail and all the labors of your hands, yet you did not turn to me, says the Lord. Are we experiencing something like this in our time? Do we see people turning to God? Are the financial regulators cracking the Bible open to get instruction about how to manage the economy? Or do we see ever greater distance between man's ways and God's ways? So I had Melissa read this article, and she was attracted to this sentence. It says, it is the first time in the company's nearly 40-year history that it has left grapes to wither on the vine. And Melissa, knowing the Bible, said, now the land gets to enjoy its Sabbath. And if we know the Bible, we'll know that she was referring to Leviticus 25, verse 3 and 4, which again I'll read for you. Leviticus 25, verse 3. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyards and gather its fruit. But in the seventh year shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land, a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall neither sow your field nor prune your vineyards. So, do you think the owners of that vineyard were obeying this command? If you read Leviticus 26, God warns, if you ignore my commandments, curses are going to come on you, including the curse of losing your homes and going into captivity. And he says, then the land will have its Sabbath. You might read in Leviticus 26, verse 35 later. It says, as long as it lies desolate, it shall rest, for the time it did not rest when you dwelt in it. We live in the times when the weekly Sabbath, the annual Sabbaths, the land Sabbaths are completely ignored. We live in times very much like those in Haggai. And what God said to those people in those times, he says to us in our times. Haggai 1, verse 7, thus says the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. So what other ways do we see that are signs of our time? Let me read a few more headlines from this newspaper. Mexican drug baron shot dead. Taliban says it shot teen campaigner for education. North Korea hits back its Seoul long-range missile move. Drugs, murder, war, hatred. That was page 10. If you flip the page over, you'd find an article with this subtitle. Mass killings by regime forces prompted outrage, but no intervention. You read another one about sexual abuse. Another one entitled, Berlin Seeks Power. Another one entitled, Armed Drones Need Global Regulation. So I know I've spoken about this before, but it's just, it amazes me that I live in a time of robotic warfare. Those are our times. You can read about the Financial Reserve borrowing billions of dollars. And this is what inspired the message today when I read this article. You can read about the same people and companies that caused the crisis getting filthy rich right now because of it. It's sort of, I mentioned, I think last time I spoke when I read Dawkins admit there's no evidence in his books, and I felt like I was in the Twilight Zone, and that's what I felt like sitting on the plane. I'm like, I have to be misunderstanding what this article says. We cannot possibly be doing the exact same things that we did before that brought on the financial crisis. So I reread it, and I found out I was wrong. Just one example, the article says, values for securities tied to low-quality mortgages that collapsed in 2007 and 2008, precipitating the financial crisis, have recovered strongly. The market rebound has been a boon for hedge funds. They are reaping some of the biggest profits since 2007. It is unbelievable. Unless you know Ecclesiastes 8, verse 11, which says, Ecclesiastes 8, verse 11, because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the hearts of the Son of Men is fully set in them to do evil. Fully set. This is the world that we came back to after the feast. So imagine this for a minute. Imagine that these people knew and kept God's commandments. What if they knew and kept God's financial laws? What if they tithed? What if they didn't oppress and lie to the poor? What if they didn't join house to house, as Isaiah 5 verse 8 says? What if they did what Hebrews 13 verse 5 says? Hebrews 13 verse 5 says, "Let your conduct be without covetousness, and be content with such things as you have." I read a book recently about a dinner party at this billionaire's house, and there's an author there. And the billionaire goes up to this author and he goes, "I made more money in the past 5 minutes than you've made in your entire life for every book you sold." And the author goes, "Yeah, but I have something you don't." And he goes, "What is that?" He said, "Enough. Enough. When is it enough?" If they obeyed, there would be no financial crisis, no food crisis, no military crisis. If we obeyed, I cannot think of a single article in that paper that would still exist. So what is it about God's way of life that is so burdensome and complex and unattractive that men seek their own way? Deuteronomy 10, if you want to turn there. Deuteronomy 10, verse 12 and 13. "And now, Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, and to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes, which I command you today for your good." So I know it's not the time for this, but I have these fantasies sometimes that instead of me going out into the world, that I could drag people from the world into the feast and they could fellowship and they could hear the messages. They could experience that it's nothing like, you know, Christmas or Easter or the unbiblical days, and show them that what they lust for, what they lie and cheat about, is nothing compared to what God is prepared to freely give them. Psalm 84, verse 11, you don't need to turn there, says this: "No good thing will God withhold from those who walk uprightly." There are no good thing. The great and amazing blessing that you and I have is to know the truth. We know how to walk uprightly. We know and comprehend not only the signs of these times, but the times of the restoration ahead of us. I started talking about the feast, and I'm going to end there also. So last night I asked Melissa what she remembered about our first year at the feast and in the UK. And her face kind of lit up, and she kind of couldn't find the words. And I could tell that she was feeling what it was like to be at the feast. And that reminded me of a quote that I used at the feast in the UK. It's from Winnie the Pooh. And Piglet asked Pooh, "How do you spell love?" And Pooh says, "You don't spell it, you feel it." And in a lot of ways, you can't understand the feast unless you experience it. So when Melissa did find the words, she said one of the most memorable things was meeting people for the first time. So for us in the UK, all the British people were brand new to us. And so we'd get together at this restaurant pub and eat and talk and get to know each other. And, you know, just really deeply wonderful people. So have you ever thought about this? You will get to do that in the millennium. People resurrected from the 1800s and from 1200 and from 1000 BC. Think of all the new people you will get to meet. People converted to spirit who are completely decent, completely kind, completely truthful. Those are the times pictured by the feast. The other thing Melissa brought up was the first time we drove to Chatsworth House. And for those who don't know, Chatsworth House is it's on this river that's nestled in these rolling green hills. Grounds are filled with deer and all these cute little puffball sheep. And in the middle of this massive estate is this beautiful, amazing mansion. And when you drive up for the first time, the first thought that you have, which Melissa brought up yesterday and almost everybody does, is that it's just millennial. It's peaceful. And if you haven't been there, I encourage you to go look at it online and also try to picture this. Something much greater, much grander, much more enduring is reserved for you. John 14, verse 2 and 3. John 14, verse 2. In my Father's house are many mansions or dwelling places, and if it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. So if we believe the Bible, then we believe that Christ right now is actively preparing a place for you. Better than Chatsworth House, better than anything you've ever seen. Verse 3, and if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, you may also be. Those times are coming, and they are certain. We know that before those times, other times are coming. Daniel 12, verse 1, you don't need to turn there. It says, and there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time. And the Bible tells us to watch. And if we are really watching, does anybody doubt that these times are quickly approaching? But the end of those times of trouble result in the beginning of another time. Daniel 12, verse 3. At that time your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book. Those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like stars forever. The rulers of this age, of these time, have put us on a collision course. Financial crisis, food crisis, military crisis, family crisis. And we must watch and not be caught off guard by these things. But just as important, and I'm sure this is why we have the feast every year, is that we must focus on other news. The news we were richly filled with at the Feast of Tabernacles, the good news of God's soon coming kingdom and rulership, the news of the best time in your and my life.